This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll speak with Ethan Nadelman from the Drug Policy Alliance.
We've got good news to report and an optimistic future. Check it out.
We'll talk about a new book, Radicals in America, the U.S. Left Since the Second World War.
This is an amazing, wonderful, enthralling book. Everyone in the movement should have a copy of Radicals in America.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael Smith, it's a pleasure to have you at my place of work, the so-called Peace Pentagon in Lower Manhattan, home to groups such as the War Resisters League, the Granny Peace Brigade, Met Council on Housing, and the A.J. Musty Memorial Institute.
You know, it's a thrill to be here. This is a famous building, of course. A.J. Musty was a person central to my own political development because I remember him from, he was going out when I was coming in the early days of the anti-war movement in 66, 67. And to now be in a building named after A.J. Musty and to be with you as the executive director of the A.J. Musty Foundation is terrific. So this is our new studio home, and it's nice to be here.
And we might get sometimes a little traffic noise in the background, but that's what you get for being on a major street in Manhattan.
Let's hear the show.
Okay. Michael Smith, I wanted to congratulate you on your recent article, No Longer a Dirty Word, appearing not only in the Independent newspaper, but also on Portside. Let me start by asking, why is socialism no longer a dirty word?
Because I think people see what we have now, and they don't like it, and they're looking for alternatives. So that you have the Merriam-Webster dictionary. It's online. The most hits they get is, what is socialism? 200,000 people came out to volunteer for Bernie Sanders, who, although he's running in the Democratic Party, calls himself a socialist, democratic socialist, kind of for reforming capitalism. But nonetheless, he's got a lot of good ideas. And same in England. Jeremy Corbyn had a huge movement inside the Labour Party that elected him as the head of the Labour Party. So you've got that phenomena, not only in England, but in the United States. Why? Well, people look around. The Walton family that owns Walmarts, the six kids in the Walton family are as rich as the bottom 40% of the population in America.
Combined.
There are 400 families in America that donate most of the money for political campaigns. Jimmy Carter, at age 90, said that we've become an oligarchy instead of a democracy. These rich people, because of the Citizens United Supreme Court case, can donate as much as they want to buy elections. And the Citizens United held, corporations are people. I'll believe that a corporation's a person the day it gets a colonoscopy.
Michael, given all of this, can we still call this country a democracy?
I think in a very, very limited way, or maybe on some local levels. But no, I would not. I would call it what Carter calls it. It's an oligarchy. It's ruled by the rich. You know, some of the famous people in American history have been socialists. America's most famous intellectual, Albert Einstein, said that socialism is humanity's attempt to overcome and advance beyond the predatory phase of human development.
Michael, what have socialists accomplished in this country?
Quite a lot. It's a hidden history, really, but let me just suggest some of it. They've gotten for us unemployment insurance, workers' compensation insurance, the 40-day work week, the weekend. My favorite is Central Park. Olmsted was a socialist. But socialists have been leaders in the fight against racism before, during, and after the Civil War. They helped form the NAACP. In the fight for civil liberties, they formed the American Civil Liberties Union. They championed public education, an end to child labor.
Public transportation.
Public transportation.
leaders in the LGBT rights movement, immigrant rights movement, prisoners' rights, and universal health care. They understand that the capitalist system requires racism, divide and conquer. They've thrown themselves into that movement. I'm from Wisconsin, and Wisconsin pulled together a battalion of soldiers and went south to fight against slavery in 1861, most of them socialists, a lot of them European refugees from Germany. I know during my own experience that socialists were prominent in the leadership of the anti-war movement in Vietnam and then in Iraq. And right now, socialists are prominent and working along with many others and agree with Pope Francis that unless capitalism is gotten rid of, this world is doomed because of climate change. So I would just conclude with another famous socialist, John Lennon, who wrote the song Imagine. And the last verse is, "You may say I'm a dreamer, but I'm not the only one. I hope someday you'll join us and the world will live as one."
Michael, if listeners want to read your article for themselves, where can they find it?
Well, it was in the Independent, I-N-D-Y, Pendant, the Independent newspaper here in New York City. And it's also online, the Portside website. So the Indy or Portside. And it's called No Longer a Dirty Word.
By Michael Stephen Smith.
Thanks, Heidi.
Thanks. In slow yet incremental steps, progress is being made toward establishing more sensible and humane drug policies in the United States. The past half century has been characterized by politically motivated hysteria around the so-called war on drugs, resulting in harsh sentencing laws and a subsequent soaring of mass incarceration rates. Half of the federal prison population is in for drug offenses, and the result has been highly detrimental to families and communities. 2 years ago, former Attorney General Eric Holder announced that the Justice Department would begin to reassess the draconian mandatory minimum sentences of nonviolent drug offenders that disproportionately target young African American and Latino males. Such public pronouncements, along with continued grassroots organizing and heightened public awareness that the war on drugs has been an abysmal failure, are helping to shift the tide in drug policies. The Drug Policy Alliance has made measurable strides in criminal justice reforms, such as helping to decriminalize marijuana in Colorado and Washington states. We welcome back Ethan Nadelman, founder and executive director of the Drug Policy Alliance, to talk about the evolution of the U.S. drug policy and recent developments around decriminalization of marijuana in some states. Ethan Nadelman, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
My pleasure.
I understand that you had a great gathering a couple of weeks ago in Washington of the Drug Policy Alliance.
Well, it's the International Drug Policy Reform Conference. It's a biennial gathering that my organization, Drug Policy Alliance, takes the lead on pulling together. But I'll tell you, we've oftentimes had about 1,000 people there moving around the country. This time we had over 1,500 people, 71 countries, incredible energy, diversity. I tend to describe the gathering as imagine a hybrid of a graduate-level seminar on drug policy policy and a three-day revival meeting, because that's really what it is. And in a way, we took on some of the toughest issues in the movement. You know, we had a huge town hall on Black Lives Matter meets drug policy reform, the difficult issues around the growing role of the marijuana industry and marijuana reform, debates over whether drug addiction is a disease or what that all means, all that sorts of stuff. And we created this big, sort of wonderful, dynamic, loving space where people could really debate these issues in the way that a growing movement needs to do.
At the convention, you talked about fear. You talked about the McCarthy period in the 50s and how fear worked. I remember when Nixon left office and they asked him what the secret was of his political success, and he said, fear. And they don't teach you that in the Boy Scouts.
Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about fear as it played out in the war on drugs, especially in the 80s and the 90s, and talk about that compared to the McCarthy period and the great Trumbo movie.
Yeah, Mike, it was interesting. As I said in my talk, I had seen the Trumbo movie like a week before the conference, and I typically don't prepare this speech until right before, and it just got me thinking. I mean, part of what it was, you know, what was the whole McCarthyist era about? I mean, there was, on the one hand, there were communist spies, and there was a threat from the Soviets, but there was not a communist spy under every bed, and the Soviets were not lapping at our borders, right? And on that fear base, you know, McCarthyism arose, and you know, but the country went along. It was a horrific period that destroyed the lives of huge numbers of people. And it really was an ugly stain in American history. And the tragedy was the ways in which many people went along. Well, I use the analogy for a couple of reasons. The first was, for a long time, I've just thought about the war on drugs that emerged, especially in the late 80s. I mean, to some extent, under Nixon, but really in the late 80s, as McCarthyism on steroids. I mean, McCarthyism did not result in millions of people being incarcerated, ripped from their families, essentially enslaved in institutions of incarceration, right? We had loyalty oaths, but massive drug testing throughout our society. You know, the propaganda campaigns in both times. So, and of course, not just in the U.S., but a kind of global projection of our own values around the world in a very, very, you know, destructive way. So in that sense, I think McCarthyism McCarthyism was sort of a small model for what we saw with the war on drugs really in the late 80s. And then the second reason I brought it up, of course, was that our gathering a few weeks ago came in the wake of what had happened in Paris, and just before what's happened in San Bernardino, and now you see what Trump is saying and doing and stuff like that. So, you know, what we know is that in these periods where the country, where people, normal middle-class people, become afraid, that's a dangerous period for a movement like drug policy reform, which advances interests of, you know, of freedom and social justice and what have you. We saw ourselves take a step back after 9/11, when all of a sudden the country became obsessed with security concerns. And I worry that right now we're at a moment where our movement has a lot of momentum right now on a range of fronts, but the broader culture of fear is something that could retard where we're going.
Now, given the current events, including exposés of police brutality across the nation, how does the movement to address drug policy issues really situate itself with things like Black Lives Matter and other growing
movements? It's incredibly complex. I mean, there's some of the pieces that are the most obvious, right, which is that although the war on drugs is not the only thing driving the sort of racist approach to criminal justice in America, it is the thing that more than anything in the 1980s and 1990s did drive it. I mean, we increased our incarceration population in America from 500,000 to 2.3 million, right? You know, fourfold increase or so. We increased the number of drug law violators from 50,000 to 500,000, almost a tenfold increase, and hundreds of thousands more for other things related to the war on drugs. The whole notion, I mean, there was always a notion of police aggressively policing inner city communities and young, especially men of color. But it was the possibility that some significant number would have a little drugs in their pocket that gave them the opportunity to put their hands in a way that really was violating fundamental rights and decencies in this country. So this war on drugs was the thing that really gave the sort of the foot on the pedal to sort of expanding this, I mean, really historically unprecedented system of incarceration. We've had historically unprecedented systems of oppression with slavery and Jim Crow. But in terms of incarceration, there's nothing like it in American history or in the history of any democratic society in history. So in that sense, there's a strong coincidence of interest. And for Drug Policy Alliance, our major concern there is taking the Black Lives Matter momentum and making sure it's infused with a deeper understanding of what's going on with drugs. Because it's all well and good to say, stop policing in this racist way, stop locking up all sorts of people, or especially black and brown people. But if you still believe that drugs need to be criminalized and that people need to lose their freedom because they got drugs in their pocket, or that we're best off keeping these markets in the hands of criminal organizations rather than trying to find ways to regulate them in a responsible way, you're going to take two steps forward and two steps back. Now, conversely, the call on us as drug policy reformers is to say, open up to the broader things that are happening in these communities. Understand the need for reinvestment in these communities. Oh, you know, open your mind to this conversation about reparations. And so my commitment and Drug Policy Alliance commitment is to try to do as best we can. And it's tricky because we're a movement that cuts across the political spectrum. You know, many of our supporters come from the libertarian side and sometimes the Republican side. And we succeed the way we do because we're building bipartisan consensus. So it's becoming one of those, you know, greater challenges of our movement.
Ethan, you say that the war on drugs is racist, and you talked about racist with respect to Chinese people, black people, Mexicans. Flesh that out for us, will you?
Sure. If you look at the origins of the drug laws, right? I mean, you know, back in the late 19th century, a lot of these drugs, heroin, cocaine, marijuana, were all legal in America. And some of them, like the opiates, were commonly used. Cocaine was in Coca-Cola till 1900. And so far as we know, it was no more addictive than Coca-Cola with caffeine and sugar is today. Most opiate consumers in the 1870s or so were middle-aged women using opiates because they didn't have penicillin, they didn't have Motrin, they were going through their period, they're going through menopause, there was, you know, bad sanitation, so lots of diarrhea, and nothing stops you up the way that opiates do, right? But nobody thought about making it illegal because nobody wanted to put their white grandma or auntie behind bars. But when the Chinese start coming to America in large numbers, you know, working on the mines and the railroads and kicking back in the evening the way they did in the old country by smoking a little opium, same way white people were kicking back with a little whiskey, well, that's when you get the first criminalizations of opium in Nevada, California, 1870s and 80s. Ditto with cocaine. You know, so long it was Sigmund Freud or, you know, Van Mariani, the Bordeaux wine or, you know, Coca-Cola, no. But once it started to be black people in the South, you know, sniffing this white powder and forgetting their proper place in society, that's when you saw the first criminalizations and demonizations. Marijuana. All about prejudice, stigma against Mexican-Americans, Mexican migrants. And in every case, the xenophobia connected to issues of color, of race, of ethnicity, of popular fears about the society changing, and linked also to what would these darker-skinned people, these immigrants, these minorities, do to our precious women and children. Right? I mean, that's why if you look and ask the question, how and why is it that certain drugs are legal and others not, historically? What you find is it has almost nothing to do with the relative risks or dangers of these drugs and almost everything to do with who used or who was perceived to use these substances.
Now, the movement to reform our drug policies has had several incremental victories. Can you give us a few highlights?
Well, I mean, the monumental one, the one that is revolutionary and transformative, is what's happening with marijuana. I mean, the fact that you now have half the states with legal medical marijuana, four states with legalization of marijuana more broadly, and D.C.'s almost there, and a half dozen going to have it on the ballot next year, and a bunch of those should win. I mean, to think that the United States, which has been the world's leading promoter of the war on drugs around the world for almost a century, has now emerged as the world's leader in terms of sensible, pragmatic marijuana policies, not at the level of federal government, although they're not being terrible at that level, but at the level of civil society, public opinion, and state government. I mean, that's really remarkable. And to take one illegal drug, which accounts not for most of the incarcerations, but for half of all the drug arrests in this country, and to remove it from the criminal system, I mean, that is just an extraordinary development that most of us would not have predicted just 5 or 6 years ago. The other front where we're seeing things moving is this incredible dynamism, and even bipartisan dynamism, about reducing incarceration in America. You have not just lots of progressive Democratic politicians, but even Republicans and leading conservatives saying, too many people behind bars, we get it, got to roll it back. They're the and there's more dynamism on this issue than almost anywhere else in the world, too. But there's two problems. One is that we're starting from so far back. We're so bad on this that we're not a model for anybody. You know, we got momentum, but try to get us from being the worst in the world to trying to be the second or third or fifth worst in the world, right? And the second problem is that a lot of the real proposals are not quite matching the rhetoric. You know, the prison industrial complex is a powerful force in America. Politicians' fears about getting Willie Horton, you know, the ads that might run against them for somebody who got let out of prison, those remain powerful forces. So it's unfortunately all of the proposals on that front are relatively incremental, but I don't see any other way to proceed except through the incremental approach.
Yeah, well, we got a little progress in the Ban the Box movement.
Well, Ban the Box, I mean, that's not so much about incarceration. That's about helping people to, you know, really, once they've been in or once they've been gotten a criminal record, to be able to get jobs. I have to tell you, I think I can speak about this publicly. I had a fascinating conversation with a high-level person at Uber last month, right? And people have all sorts of views about Uber and that quote-unquote share economy. But what became apparent is he was saying to me, we have no evidence that drug testing drivers or doing background checks or even criminal background checks does anything to improve consumer safety or satisfaction because of the entire seat, both the surveillance system they have and the feedback system they have. And that's a remarkable development because it means that you have a growing area of the economy where you have evidence that there's no need to find out whether somebody had a criminal record, no need to drug test people without cause. And that those are among the good variables that I think can help move us in a better direction. I mean, given we have, 15 million Americans living with a felony conviction, we got to find some way to enable them to get legal jobs.
I was interested that you noted that drug courts may do more harm than good. Can you explain?
Yeah, I mean, drug courts, everybody jumped on drug courts, not everybody, but many, you know, judges who wanted to do decent things and others back 20, 25 years ago when the view was lock them all up. And relative to lock them all up, it looked pretty good. But when you start to actually look at the evidence and when you look at the ways that drug courts operate in the U.S. relative to other countries, what you see is that a significant number of the people they're picking up are people whose only offense is drug possession. Those are people who should not be in the clutches of the criminal justice system in the first place. Drug courts, if they're working well in the way they work outside this country, focus on people involved in predatory crimes, theft, other things who happen to have a serious drug addiction. The second thing you see is that people picked up in drug courts oftentimes don't have a serious drug problem. They're just violating a drug law. They're not a problematic drug user, but the only way the system can deal with them is to put them into this ridiculous, you know, pseudo-treatment system. The third thing you see is that the only types of treatment permitted when you're cooked up in the criminal justice system are abstinence only, where you go to jail if you keep using. Well, anybody who's used cigarettes or booze or had a problem knows you don't quit the first or second or third time. It can take a lot of times. So the whole harm reduction approach, the whole one step at a time, the whole pragmatic science-based approach, you know, says that the criminal justice system is not the best place for applying drug treatment. So drug court judges, most of them won't allow somebody who's a heroin addict or in a methadone program to go into a methadone program if they get picked up. That's totally opposite what all the research says. So there's a lot of reasons why drug courts, not all, there are some drug court judges doing the Lord's work around this country, but it's why the system as a whole is two steps forward, three steps back.
What about the asset forfeiture?
Well, I mean,
scam.
That's an issue that we worked on back in the – we did two ballot initiatives in Oregon and Utah back in 2000. And we basically found that a substantial majority of Americans hate two things about asset forfeiture. They hate the fact that cops and prosecutors can seize the property or money or whatever of somebody based solely on suspicion, right, and keep it. Right?
For
and
themselves.
That you have to fight. And secondly, if they keep it for themselves, their own departments, right? Rather than going to General Treasury. So we passed these two initiatives in 2000. Oregon, you go by 2-1 margin. Great left-right coalitions, libertarians, property owners, libertarians, civil rights groups. And then what happened was law enforcement came back through the legislative process, as they could in those states, and gutted much of what we had accomplished. Well, now the issue's back, and it's picking up a lot of traction. Once again, growing left-right coalitions. This time it's being much more framed in a civil rights perspective, because if you look at that, it was a fantastic piece in New Yorker magazine a year or two ago, just focusing on the extent to which you have racial disproportionality and who's getting their asset seized. But all the right-wingers, the libertarians, and others also get it from a property rights perspective. John Oliver, by the way, anybody want a 20-minute primer on this? John Oliver did a 20-minute riff on asset forfeiture last year. It has 5 or 10 million views on YouTube. That's the thing that everybody should be the starting point because it is so highly substantive and accurate. So we're working New Mexico earlier this year. My office up there led an effort with the ACLU and some right-wing organizations, libertarian ones, that basically eliminated civil asset forfeiture. And now we have to fight to keep that reform in place and push it forward in other states.
You were talking in D.C. about really one of the bad guys in this whole picture, William Bennett, the drug czar. And I wanted to ask you how you think history is going to evaluate Mr. Bennett.
Well, I think he's going to come close to being perceived like Senator McCarthy was. I mean, if you think William Bennett's monumental contribution was in a period of profound fear in America around drugs in our kids, and also drugs as a surrogate for fears around race and changes there. He was the one, I think, who really came up more than anybody, not solely him, but where he really figured out how to use the drug issue to advance really reactionary political values among ordinary middle-class centrist Americans and to seize on their fears in order to get really, to have horrific, his rhetoric is going to look so like McCarthy's other stuff does now. The policies advocated for which we're trying to roll back now are just going to look like absolutely inhumane. I hope they're regarded at one point in the future as fundamentally un-American. But Bennett really is going to go in that way. Now, I should say, in the conference, I also made another point about William Bennett, which was when I went to visit Ram Dass, the kind of thinker and spiritual guide, years ago when I was just starting the organization, and asked for his advice. And one of his pieces of advice was, well, Ethan, you need to learn to love William Bennett. And, I've struggled a lot with that one.
It's very funny, Ethan.
Because, I realized that ultimately what he means was we can't ultimately prevail unless we learn how to embrace and address and own the fears of the people who we're trying to persuade. William Bennett tapped into that. He may well always go down as a venal force in America, but understanding and learning to love that piece of him that on a heart and human level resonated with people at that time, I think that's the only way we succeed long term.
We just have a few minutes left. Could you briefly sort of summarize the gains we've made thus far and the challenges ahead?
Yeah. People say, oh, this marijuana thing is one. But the fact is we have 4 states down, 46 to go, 1 country down, Uruguay, and 199 or so to go. So it's not there. It's not in the bag. I worry about overconfidence. There's a lot to do. And whatever we can do to try to create a more ethically minded industry, because what's happening now is people are coming in and just seeing this as anything else. And I think the ability of organizations like mine to shape the future of marijuana legalization is going to diminish rapidly in future years. We're now drafting or co-drafting many of these initiatives, but jump forward, if we keep succeeding 5 or 6 years from now, it'll be the industry. And the good part is they'll be using their for-profit interests in order to end marijuana prohibition. The bad side is that their number one interest will be their profits and not some of the broader social justice values. I think secondly, because of the fear factor happening in America right now, I worry that could, permeate the broader atmosphere and lead people, the momentum for reducing the punitiveness of policing and incarceration, that could begin to dwindle if people start to freak out. I worry about, another 9/11 type event happening or some other monumental disaster that causes people to get scared. On other fronts, I'm really inspired by what just happened in Canada with Justin Trudeau's victory. The last prime minister there, Stephen Harper, was like a throwback to the Republicans of the late 90s on these issues. And the fact that he was roundly rejected, that Trudeau has a strong majority, that he committed to legalizing marijuana and advancing sentencing reform and harm reduction even before he was elected is enormously promising. And that means that Canada is going to catapult from being a laggard over the last 10 years to being a leader again, which is promising because in April of this coming year, the United Nations will have its first General Assembly special session on drugs since 1998. And there's a global mobilization around that. We don't think we'll reform UN policy, but it's a moment for for us to really pick things up. I think in Latin America, Mexico has some real rumblings right now, and the prospect of California legalizing is getting them to think afresh about this. There's more political leadership, more people willing to run for office now in America on using the rhetoric of "I want to reform drug policies and criminal justice policies." That's promising. So I'd say more good than bad. We have the wind at our backs, but we got a long way to go.
We've been talking with Ethan Nadelman from the Drug Policy Alliance. Ethan, how do our listeners get in touch with the Drug Policy Alliance?
Well, just go to drugpolicy.org and sign up for emails. That's the best way. We have offices around the country. We're helping support and fund organizations working all around the country. I mean, we really believe in building this movement across the spectrum in every way possible.
It's been a pleasure to have you.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Ethan. Good luck.
Okay.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
Radicals in the United States, often controversial and frequently dismissed by the status quo people, have nevertheless played a significant role in leading and mobilizing many social justice movements. In his recently published book, Radicals in America, the U.S. Left Since the Second World War, co-author Christopher Phelps has compiled a comprehensive and enthralling history of radicalism in America from the Second World War all the way up to and through the 1999 WTO protests in Seattle and the Occupy Wall Street movement here in New York and across the country 3 years ago. The list of accomplishments by the left is significant, including racial integration, desegregation of the armed forces, the founding and maintenance of labor unions, the birthing of feminism, the movement to enable women to control their own bodies, and the anti-war movement during Vietnam. The authors of Radicals in America explain how successive generations joined movements of dissent, faced political setbacks and repression, and yet have still succeeded in sparking the imagination amongst mass movements. We're joined today by co-author Christopher Phelps, an historian of American political and intellectual life who teaches American studies at the University of Nottingham in England.
Christopher Phelps, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Oh, thank you very much.
Congratulations on your new book. And we'd like to start by asking you, what is a radical?
Well, it's interesting that you ask that because I've been hearing a lot in the news media in the last few days about radicalization in reference to Islamists who are actually arch conservatives if you look at their worldview and what they want to do and their kind of sense of history. They want to turn things back to the 6th century. But in our book, it's left-wing radicals. It's radicals who are in fundamental opposition to the existing structures of the society, who want to go to the root. That's the original meaning of the word radical. They want to go all the way down to the root and branch. They don't just, for instance, want to pair social problems at the surface with social policy, but they actually want to overturn the causes of poverty and war and social injustice. So it's at radicals who are motivated by equality, freedom, a sense of a more peaceful and ecological world. Those are the sorts of radicals who we're focusing on.
Christopher, the subtitle of Radicals in America is The U.S. Left Since the Second World War. And the book starts off with the most extraordinary case of Winfred Lynn and his challenge to segregation in the armed forces, because people may not know that the American armed forces were segregated at the beginning of the Second World War, the War for Democracy. And the book starts out kind of profiling Winfred Lynn and telling the story. And we'd like to ask you to tell that story in a nutshell for us.
Right. Well, the case came to us partly because he's a gardener who lived in Queens, and gardeners, of course, get to the root. But Winfred Lynn was a African-American who was asked to serve in the military. He was in his early 30s, and he wrote back to his draft board, "I'd be perfectly willing to serve, opposed to Nazi Germany and fascist Italy and Imperial Japan, but I will not serve in any unit that's a Jim Crow unit. In other words, I won't serve in an all-black unit presided over by white officers in the segregated military." And he began to legally contest this course. The case was so seen as so radical and potentially unpatriotic that the NAACP wouldn't even take it at the time, even though they, of course, are a civil rights organization. And he ended up having some radical lawyers, including his brother, Conrad Lynn, a very radical lawyer, take on the case, and they ended up telling him, "We'll actually fight this policy better if you serve." And so he did, and he went and he served in combat in the Pacific, made the rank of sergeant, and his case made it up all the way through the court system to the Supreme Court, which declined to hear it. But it was nonetheless judged the most significant challenge legally to military segregation during the Second World War. And after the war, his case was upheld by A. Philip Randolph, a black civil rights and labor leader of the day, a sort of Martin Luther King now forgotten of the 40s. And Randolph, when he testified before Congress in 1948, referred to the famous Winfred Lynn case in making the case that the military should be desegregated in the context of the Cold War, or else African Americans might well resist serving. And this was a successful message, and Harry S. Truman ended up desegregating the military, one of the initial steps toward what we think of as the Civil Rights Revolution. So somebody who was seen as a pariah and completely radical and utopian in the context of the Second World War in imagining that race shouldn't be a basis for partitioning the various units of the military was within just a few years affecting national policy.
At the end of your recounting of this, you mentioned that Truman's executive order was a vague one concerning the timetable for segregation in the military, and that many radicals thought that it was actually postponing justice in this instance. And I was delighted to read your mention of A.J. Mustie and Bayard Rustin, who helped carry forward a civil disobedience campaign. We're actually taping in a building dubbed the Peace Pentagon, and I'm the executive director of the A.J. Mustie Memorial Institute. So we were really thrilled to see mention of our hero.
Yeah, well, let's talk about A.J. Mustie, really one of the unsung heroes in American history. I knew him, of course, from the anti-war movement. He was getting out of it and died in 67, and I was getting into it. But Mustie was a labor leader, led one of the great strikes in 34, a founder of the Congress of Racial Equality, a founder of the War Resisters League. Talk to us about A.J. Mustie, would you please?
A.J. Mustie is one of a number of radical pacifists who we write about in the book. I think the book is unique in that most histories of the left focus on the socialist and Marxist organizations that are kind of at the core of the story at mid-century, but we try to broaden it out and to pay attention to all of the rivulets, including the pacifists, who I don't think always get their due in general histories of the political left. Musty was a figure who had a kind of moral credibility because he had been on the revolutionary left in the 30s, and as you say, a labor leader, but then had moved to the radical pacifist movement. He probably appears in our book the most strongly in 1956, when the Communist Party is in free fall because of several things that happen. Khrushchev's secret speech that reveals the nature of Stalin's crimes and the putting down of the Hungarian Revolution and workers' councils. And there's an attempt then to have a kind of wide dialogue on the left between people leaving the Communist Party and people in other kinds of pacifist and socialist groups. And Musty is the one with the kind of credibility at that point to pull everyone together. But his whole circle of, you know, Bayard Rustin and the War Resisters League and Musty's a really interesting figure, and what I think our book does, which a lot of histories of the left don't really do, is to tell the history of radical pacifism in among all of the other strands of the left. And most histories of the left pay a lot of attention to the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and the kind of Marxist left, which we do, but we fold in a lot of things about Musty and his whole circle. And this includes, for example, the conscientious objectors to the Second World War and Dwight MacDonald's magazine Politics, which saw in a war that a lot of the left saw as an anti-fascist war, a lot of ominous developments in the emergence of a strong bureaucratic state and the atomic bomb. And then radical pacifists in the 50s were important in resisting nuclear weapons, and we see all of that, including A.J. Musty and his role in 1956 when he was kind of a moral authority on the left in helping draw people together at a time when the Communist Party was disintegrating because of a crisis of Stalinism in Eastern Europe and Hungary and Khrushchev's famous speech admitting to Stalin's many crimes. There was a kind of big conversation on the left, which Musty was critical in helping pull together, and all of that is a prelude to the 60s. So Musty is a figure of moral authority, but more importantly, he's sort of the tip of a whole swath of the left that's very pacifist in its orientation, and which, because of that pacifism, is often dismissed as utopian or sort of weak, but in fact, very important seedbed for critical thinking about war and empire.
Skipping ahead now, because your book is divided up, but not into decades, but almost that, and I want to fast forward because you write about two people who actually were clients of our co-host, Michael Ratner. Michael was the president of the Center for Constitutional Rights, and he represented Ben Linder. And then he also represented Winola LaDuc. And I wanted to ask you about Linder and LaDuc. Could you talk about them, please?
Yeah. Well, what you're getting at is that one of the structures of the book is that we open each chapter, which is on a particular chronological period, with a radical who's not necessarily representative, but somehow really helps us get at the kinds of issues that the left is confronting in that period and trying to move from being on the margin, being radical fringe, to affecting change by winning over hearts and minds and transforming a mainstream. And Linder is story of the 1980s, and it actually is my favorite opening of all the openings in the book, but it's a very kind of dark opening because it's the Reagan era and tides are turning and it's much harder to be a radical. And Linder is someone who trained as an engineer at the University of Washington and was quite talented, but in that moment of kind of a new boom in Pentagon spending and all that, he said, I'm not going to go to work in the aerospace industry. I'm not going to take a job at Boeing. And instead, he decided to put his skills, his scientific skills, to work in Central America, in Nicaragua, where there'd been a revolution, the Sandinista Revolution. And he worked on appropriate technology in the mountains of Nicaragua with the peasants trying to bring electricity to a village that had never had electricity before in a small kind of micro power station in the stream, where he was killed by the Contras, who were armed by the CIA. And so it's a story of heroism, and it's a story of commitment, and it's a story of how far some radicals, you know, the cost some radicals paid for their commitment. And it kind of is metaphorical for the crisis of the left in the 80s, the way I feel about the Linder opening. Winona LaDuke is an Ojibwe from northern Minnesota who actually was raised in Oregon and California, but ended up returning to her father's reservation, the White Earth, and has a real kind of mixing of Native American, feminist, and ecological principles in the kinds of things that she does. She's famous around the country for having been Ralph Nader's running mate in the year 2000, and yet a lot of her activism is really local. And she's also global in her commitment. So, I mean, what makes it kind of interesting is she's both indigenous in the most fundamental sense and at the same time very global in her activism. So, you know, she spoke before a United Nations commission in Switzerland when she was just a teenager. She represented, she was one of American women's group representatives at a 1995 conference on women in Beijing. And she thinks about kind of global trade and global justice issues and is part of that kind of Seattle moment down to the present in which a global justice movement and an ecological movement worldwide is trying to gain traction in very difficult times.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Christopher Phelps, co-author of the new book, Radicals in America, The U.S. Left Since the Second World War. Christopher, why do you say that you can explain the radical left with the words liberty, equality, and solidarity?
Those are the famous words of the French Revolution, liberté, égalité, et fraternité. But fraternité means fraternity, and of course is a gendered term, and so we replace it with solidarity. We think those are the kind of defining commitments. Now, of course, the way they get interpreted, the way they get thought about, varies from radical to radical and from group to group, of course, and part of the book is about, I mean, what I think brings the book alive and what we tried to do is to not flatten out all the debates, but rather to have them all in the book and have all the contesting points of view, because the experience of being an activist and the experience of being on the left is very much one of argument, and not counterproductive argument, not demoralizing argument, well, sometimes, but, you know, fruitful argument, because there are real problems of strategy and vision. So to us, those terms help that kind of moral commitment to freedom, equality, and solidarity is what is at the core of the left as a project.
Christopher, you have a particularly eloquent paragraph in your book's conclusion on page 319, the second paragraph. And I wonder whether you might read that paragraph for our audience.
Assuming you have the book in front of you.
I just got it here. Is it the one that begins at present?
Yes.
At present, a negative futurity, dystopian and apocalyptic, threatens to overwhelm the radical imagination. One of frightening climate deterioration leading to food and resource scarcity, of police states crystallizing within the hollowed-out shell of corporate-dominated democracies, and of an extreme capitalism, even more ruthless, in which the 1% of people own 46% of the world's wealth, with the United States as most skewed among all nations. To prevent or dislodge such outcomes will require adopting a cold realism and facing such probabilities squarely. But dreadful warnings of catastrophes to come will not do. Worsening conditions will not automatically produce radicalizations, for they're perfectly capable of generating right-wing authoritarianism. Resources of hope are needed, offering a future orientation that identifies constituencies and roads forward, seeking to involve wide circles of others well beyond the present delimited colonies of radical maroons. Any socialism, if that's the name by which the ideal survives, must reflect egalitarian, democratic, and social values while not forsaking the liberalizing rights revolution. This suggests, then, that a libertarian socialism inclined to decentralization but valuing organization, suspicious of the strong state but unafraid to undertake assertive political engagement, and clearly democratic in its decision-making, a politics that might well be forged out of the resources provided by present left-of-center social movements and the forces of radicalism already loosely informed by such an ethos.
Beautifully stated, Christopher. Thank you. You know, I found your book actually enthralling because it embodies the spirit of resistance. And I wanted to ask you a personal question, if I might. You're teaching in England now, but you're an American citizen, and you know about what you write about. How did you get politicized here in America?
Well, writing this book was, in some ways, you know, there's bits of autobiography that appear in there very subtly and surreptitiously. But you're right, I'm a political person. I actually was an 80s college student and was very active in the Central America Solidarity Movement, in the South Africa Divestment Movement, and various other movements. And so I've been active on the left since the late 70s, early 80s, and you know, at Reed College in the 80s, I was a civil disobedient, I guess you could say, in which we occupied administration buildings trying to persuade that supposedly liberal arts college to divest of its holdings in South Africa, and they never did. They, in fact, expelled us. But
I didn't know that.
that's the background. That's the source, I suppose. And then, you know, I did some anti-nuclear work, actually for the Lawyers Committee on Nuclear Policy in New York City in the 80s, and also worked for Nuclear Times magazine for a while. There was a whole ecosystem of anti-nuclear stuff in the 80s. And, you know, one thing or another, I still remain committed, but you're right, I'm in another country, and you have to be a little bit deferential to those who are native and let them really take the lead in politics, I think. So most of my life now is as an intellectual rather than an activist, I think.
Well, you've got Jeremy Corbyn, and and we envy you. Christopher.
We did indeed. Now, there's something going on, you know, with the Corbyn and Sanders, and of course we're seeing a polarization. We're also seeing the Yahoo Right return with a vengeance. So, but it's interesting times.
It sure is, that old Chinese curse. Christopher Phelps, you and Howard Brick wrote a terrific book that we encourage all of our listeners to get and read. It's called Radicals in America, the U.S. Left Since the Second World War. Congratulations. We're grateful to your hard work and grateful for your being on Law and Disorder.
Well, thank you very much. I'm so appreciative.
Thank you so much. Bye-bye.
Take it easy.
All right.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.